It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, cold adventures. Bobsledding at the Winter Olympics in Sochi is on the chilly side, but try rowing a boat across 20,000 miles of Arctic water, past icebergs and polar bears, or swimming with penguins in the Antarctic, or playing football at Lambeau Field with the wind chill 50 below zero. It's a Winter Games hour. Stories of athletes and adventure in unbelievably cold places.
I did go on because I had a school of dolphins. They would suddenly leap out of the water and then spin and spiral and click and squeak and chatter. And they stayed with me for about an hour. In that time, I sort of lost the sense of, I can't do this anymore. So I kept going.
Calling Lynn Cox a swimmer is like calling Peyton Manning good at throwing a ball. At age 14, she swam to Catalina Island from mainland California. At 18, she swam between the islands of New Zealand. She broke the men's and women's records for the English Channel, and she crossed the Strait of Magellan. Then she decided to take on Antarctica. A few years ago, she told a disbelieving Steve Paulson how she swam the Antarctic without a wetsuit.
The currents and tides aren't mapped. They've been studying them down there for 17 years, and people still don't know which way the currents move. And usually when you do a channel swim, that's one of the basic things that you figure out ahead of time. Also, the weather there is so unstable. It can go from a very calm to 60-knot winds within 15 or 20 minutes. There's also the problem of ice. You can have glaciers snap off and become icebergs, and if you're swimming around them, it can be a bad thing. So those were some of the challenges, but also beyond that, there was the wildlife. There were orcas, killer whales, and there were also leopard seals that are 10 feet long and weigh up to 1,000 pounds, and they can be aggressive. And actually, a British researcher was killed by one about 3 months after I was down there.
So you like this kind of danger, is what you're telling me.
I like this kind of exploration. I like the idea of pushing the body beyond what's been done and sort of feeling out what human beings can do and how far that reach can be. Also, the other idea is that you're sort of jumping into this unexplored territory where people haven't been before in a bathing suit cap and goggles. And just the sensation of it is so extraordinary to be in water that's 32 degrees and realize it feels so viscous because it is so thick, because it is so dense. And it's just weird to have that kind of experience. But more than that, the water there is so clear. You can see as if it's like moving through sky.
Now, you had actually been training for this particular swim in the Antarctic for 2 years. What did you do to get ready for this extremely cold water?
I did things I'd never done before. I sort of became a sprinter. Instead of training and going 4 or 5 hour swims, I wound up doing an hour in my folks' backyard pool, swimming head up and moving arms as fast as I could for an hour, and basically trying to simulate what I would be doing something similar to in Antarctica. The biggest thing I really needed to do was to learn how to swim more with my head up and at the same time have the power to move through the water.
Now, the reason for swimming with the head up is it's just too cold. You lose too much body heat if you have your head in the water.
That's exactly right. You lose up to 80% of your heat through your head. You know that, being in Wisconsin. And so the idea was that if I could swim head up, I would be able to prolong my ability to stay in the cold. But at some point, you know, you get tireder because you're pressing your entire body against the water. You're sort of almost swimming it upright. So in order to compensate for that, I had to do a whole lot more weight training.
Did you also just spend time in the cold, whether it's cold water or cold air, just kind of hanging out to try to get used to it?
Yes, I went to Ushuaia, Argentina, at the very tip of Argentina, and trained in the harbor there, where the water temperature was about 40 degrees. And actually, it was so cold that it would take me pretty much all day to psych up to go in for my workout. And then I'd sort of put my clothes down on the beach, and hopefully they wouldn't blow into the water. There's some days the winds were between 40 and 50 knots, and it was just hard getting in. And yet, I knew I had to do this to prepare for the swim in Antarctica.
Now, we've been talking about some of the preparation you did to get ready for this swim in the Antarctic. One thing was to try to figure out what you'd do after you got out of the water, because there was a real danger of hypothermia, and these temperatures could kill an ordinary person in not very many minutes.
Yeah, actually, I found out from a professor at the University of Edmonton that the normal response to falling into water that's below 40 degrees is that you'll start to seize up after 6 or 8 minutes. You won't be able to have the muscular impulses, the neuromuscular impulses to make the muscles move. And so he thought this was just astonishing that I could even swim in that water. But the biggest concern I had really was for afterwards, because when you're no longer creating heat through muscle activity, you start to get cold. And then you start to bring in the cool blood from the exterior body and put it into your core of your body, and you get what's called afterdrop. And so your temperature starts to plummet, and that's when you can have really big problems where your heart can go into arrhythmia or something worse. So what we did instead was to get a scarf and a polypropylene shirt and some pants. And a friend of mine sewed pockets into them. So the pockets were on either side of my neck, under my armpits, and right near the hip bones. And we put hot packs in those areas, those things that you use when you go skiing and you get cold and you want to warm up your fingers or your toes. That's what we did. So when I finished the swim, I put those clothes on, but I also had my doctor friends who basically acted like penguins and moved in really, really close to me and hugged me and gave me their body heat. And I sort of shivered for an hour and got my temperature back up to normal.
Hmm. Now, it's worth pointing out that you are a medical marvel. For some reason, temperatures that would kill a lot of other people don't for you. And scientists have actually tested your body, your physiology. What have they discovered about you?
They've discovered that I am able to close down the circulation to the peripheral area, to the skin and to the fingers and toes and hands and feet really rapidly and keep it closed down. If you took an untrained person and put them in the cold, you'd have that response initially. And then at some point, the body would say, you know, we need to get oxygen out to those tissues. And so they would send, the body would start sending surges of blood out there and then bring that cooled blood back to the core. But my body basically says, lose the hands, lose the feet, keep the core warm and keep the brain and lungs and heart going. And it also will sort of send out a minute amount of blood to the extremities at the fingertip level and at the toe level.
Okay, so you had your practice swim. You realized you could do that. And now it was time for the real one, for the whole 1 mile, touching land on Antarctica. What happened?
Well, we took the ship down to an area called Paradise Harbor, and we were looking for beaches where I could land. There are areas that are huge glaciers and that just sort of slide right down to the ocean. And you can't swim near those glaciers because you're afraid of the falling icebergs. So we kept looking for places where we could land, but there weren't many because the wind had shifted and the icebergs had sort of accumulated in different areas, and a lot of them were the beaches. So we searched for probably half the morning until we came to a place called Niuko Harbor. And it's this just beautiful area where the beach is maybe an 800-yard wide strip that's sort of terracotta stoned, and there are glaciers on either side of it. And we saw that the weather was fairly calm and decided that it was a good day for a swim.
So you just hopped in the water and did your mile.
That's pretty much it. I mean, there's really no time to sort of quibble or second guess or wonder. The crew had been through the test swim. They knew what they needed to do. And so I went into the cabin to sort of sit down and focus. And actually, I got some temperature measurements before and after the swim. And so we found that taking the core temperature before I even started the swim, my temperature was up to 102.2. And then when I finished the swim, it was down to 95.5. And within an hour, it was back up to normal.
Hmm. How difficult was that swim?
Really, 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 really hard. It was the most difficult thing I've ever done, mostly because I had done the test swim only a day before, and it took a huge amount out of me. And also, I had some nerve damage from that first swim. So I realized that my first line of defense of being able to tell how I was doing on the peripheral area, you know, on the skin level, was gone. But it was also hard because I really didn't like shivering so hard at the end of the first test swim. Your body has to work awfully hard when it's that cold to get warm again. And I think I was working as hard shivering as I had done during that first test swim. And I actually thought, you know what? I swam 0.9 miles. Maybe that should count as the Antarctic mile. This is all true. It's like, oh, no. And then I thought, you know, I've come this far. And this would be short as a goal, and I really should go for the mile. And I really wanted to swim to the continent, you know, not the subcontinent. And this was 32-degree water, and it was just that degree more. And so I think I just decided that it was time to do it when the conditions are right, and we went forward.
Now, it sounds just miserable. I mean, it's basically a survival test. Can you do it? Is there anything at all enjoyable about this?
It's not miserable, and it's not a survival test. I mean, those are elements in it, but it's also the idea that you are jumping into unknown waters, that you are swimming through water that is so clear that you can see penguins jumping in toward the end of the swim and swimming with you. You can see them porpoising through the water and see their water bubbles coming up all around you. And you are sort of in a world that nobody else has really been in this way before, or maybe even wanted to ever do it that way.
So what did it feel like at the end when you touched land? Did you have this great sense of triumph?
I had this great sense of triumph because it was as if we had done something never done. And I had a group of people around me who had shared in this idea and this dream. And I felt like it was an achievement that we really all shared.
Now, you've said this was your hardest swim that you've ever done, but you've done some pretty hard swims in earlier years. I mean, there was one, for instance, down in New Zealand where you, after, what, a few hours, you actually were further back from where you had started from because the waves were so big?
Actually, that's exactly right. I had been swimming between the North and South Islands of New Zealand. And there were two storms converging, and we weren't aware of it because we didn't have the weather satellite stuff that we have now. And so after 5 hours of swimming, I was further from the finish than I had started. The current had carried me around the North Island, and I was really fighting to go on.
But you did go on.
Well, I did go on because I had a school of dolphins who came in and started swimming with me, with the people in the boats. They were all around our boats. The water visibility was about 50 feet, and you could look down and see dolphins swimming around dolphins. And they would suddenly leap out of the water and then spin and spiral and click and squeak and chatter. And they stayed with me for about an hour. And in that time, I sort of lost the sense of, I can't do this anymore. So I kept going. And periodically throughout the next, I don't know how many hours, the swim wound up taking 12 hours and 2 minutes. But throughout the swim, the dolphins would come back in moments when I didn't feel like I could go any further. And actually, toward the end of the swim, they wound up guiding us right into an area where I could land on shore.
Hmm. And the story then of what happened throughout New Zealand, I mean, it sounds like it almost turned into a national celebration that you had done this swim.
Actually, while I was swimming and having so many difficulties, people throughout New Zealand began calling out to the ship's radio to say, you know, Lynn, we believe in you. Keep going. There were Boy Scouts from Christchurch and beekeepers from Wellington and people all over the country, even as far as the Bay of Islands to the north, were calling and saying, keep going. And actually, the Prime Minister of New Zealand called and said, you have the country of New Zealand behind you. So it was really extraordinary. And actually, during the swim, there were a couple ships that went across Cook Straits, and they came in and raised the American flag and tooted their horns and basically showed their support. So by the time I finished the swim, pretty much all the country, you know, the land of Hillary, knew about my swim. And then the next day, church bells were rung throughout the country at noon.
Lynn Cox tells the story of her cold adventure in a book called Swimming to Antarctica. Steve Paulson talked with her. You know, it's been pretty chilly for a lot of people this week. And with the polar vortex, the Winter Olympics, and the Super Bowl all roughly coinciding this year, those of us who live up here in Packerland have been remembering one of the most historic football games ever played, the Ice Bowl. Commentator Bill Pavletic takes us back.
December 31st, 1967 is a date unlike any other in the history of professional football. The Green Bay Packers were scheduled to play the Dallas Cowboys. The winner would be crowned champion of the National Football League. When Vince Lombardi arrived at Lambeau Field that morning, the grass gridiron resembled the surface of a glacier. Temperatures held steady at minus 13 degrees with a wind chill factor of 38 below. Even the hardiest of Packer fans among the sellout crowd struggled with those conditions. Lambeau Field's press box provided no refuge.
By any yardstick, it is indeed cold in Green Bay.
When CBS color analyst Frank Gifford reached for his cup of coffee, it had frozen solid.
It's the coldest field I've ever seen for football.
The game itself looked as if it would be decided early. Quarterback Bart Starr threw a pair of touchdown passes to wide receiver Boyd Dowling. The Packers took a 14-10 lead into halftime. But following a scoreless third quarter, Dallas took its first lead of the day. The numbing cold made it downright improbable either team would score again. But the entire Packers organization understood what hung in the balance. The Packers' offense would have to navigate across 68 yards of ice-slicked turf.
This possession could represent the Packers' last chance.
In 11 plays, Green Bay found themselves at third down and goal on the Dallas 1-yard line. Just 16 seconds remained on the game clock. The sun descended behind Lambeau Field's scoreboard. Long, dark shadows draped Starr and his Packers teammates as they broke the huddle to execute the play. Brown right, 31 wedge. Starr, taking the snap on a quick count, tucked the ball into his stomach, lowered his helmet, and drove forward to his right. Offensive guard Jerry Kramer and center Ken Bowman created a momentary gap in the Dallas defensive line, allowing Starr to lunge into the end zone. After Don Chandler's extra point made it 21-17, the gun sounded. The euphoric Lambeau Field crowd erupted. Fans stormed the field. In the locker room, the team's jubilation was comparatively subdued.
Coach, can you compare this with any of the other ones? Everybody always says, is this one of the greatest Packers?
It's a little bit too early to compare anything with anyone. We have another game to play.
Vince Lombardi drove his men to be champions under any circumstances. As in life, courage, oftentimes in the harshest of conditions, precedes greatness.
Bill Pavletic is a documentary filmmaker and the author of Green Bay Packers, Trials, Triumphs, and Tradition. Feeling chilly yet? Snuggle in, we've got more cold adventures coming up on To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, in honor of all those athletes heading to the Winter Olympics in Sochi, we're talking about people who've achieved remarkable things in epic cold temperatures. For instance, Jill Fredston. She and her husband have rowed more than 20,000 miles of Arctic water. A couple of years ago, she wrote a beautiful book about their adventures, rowing the coastlines of Alaska and Canada and Greenland. It's called Rowing to Latitude, And when the book came out, she told Jim Fleming that every day of these trips is
the kind of day where so much happens, you can't believe how lucky you are to be on Earth in this place. And we saw three polar bears, one of which was just swimming right alongside us. We saw a bird rookery with more birds than we'd seen in our lives, with the baby birds making their first flight. And then we did a crossing in the fog, and rowing in fog is pretty disorienting. You almost sometimes can't figure out if you're pulling through water or air. So after an hour of this crossing, I started looking over my shoulder for land and made out the slope, and then I made out this thing that didn't make any sense at all. And one of the things we're taught to do in rescue work in Alaska is, let's say we're looking for a down plane. You don't look for a plane because it may not look like a plane anymore. So you look for something that doesn't look like everything else around it. And I kept doing that, and finally I asked Doug if he saw what I was seeing above my head, and he didn't even look. He laughed, and finally, the fog cleared, and I was right. There was this whale that was just hanging up on the side of the mountain that was about 20 feet long. It was missing its head, and the question was, how did it get there? Did it get pushed up by a big wave, or did it melt out of the glacier that had retreated about a half mile around the corner? And we told some scientists about it when we got back to the one town there is a month later. And
their reaction, by the way, if I remember correctly, was about the same as Doug's, that you could not possibly have seen what you were saying.
They didn't really believe us. Yeah, they didn't think we had a lot of credibility. But they finally went and dated it. And about 2 years later, a paper showed up with the results.
How old was it?
It dated between 1535 and 1660. So it lived in Shakespeare's time. And that was the Little Ice Age. So what must have happened is the whale died, floated up on the beach, was incorporated into this glacier, advancing glacier, and now the glaciers have retreated and it dropped out.
That same day, as you said, you saw three polar bears. Each time, again, if I remember correctly, you were trying to find a place to camp. Must have been great frustration.
We were tired. The winds were blowing 80 miles an hour, fortunately offshore. So if we went right along the shore, we were okay. But yeah, every time we tried to pull in on a beach, a polar bear had beat us to it.
Is this typical? Knowing that that's going to happen, you continue to go out to do this, so it must not be too frustrating.
My family keeps wondering why we've rowed 21,000 miles in the north and never gone anywhere where the water is warmer than 45 degrees. And I think the reason is that we really like wild country. And for the most part, the wild country is going to be where there's the fewest people. And that's going to tend to be where the weather has its challenging moments.
Well, tell me about your boats.
The boats have evolved over the years. For the first 13,000 miles, Doug was in a kayak and I was in a rowing boat. What I mean by a rowing boat is it's essentially a kayak hull, but it has a different deck on top. So it has a sliding seat and 9-foot-9 oars, so you're sculling. And the boat's about 19 and a half feet long, weighs 65 pounds. We go in two boats, which I think is one secret to liking each other when you're spending 4 or 5 months together. If we need to, we can hold as much as 100 days of food. We'd rather not because it sinks the boats right down to the gunwales. But having that much food also means tremendous range.
And you go out for months at a time.
What we do is we work 7 days a week in the winter as avalanche specialists in Alaska, and then we take off from May to September and just explore. And usually the trips are 3, 4, or 5 months. It depends. We rode the coast of Norway from Sweden to Russia, which is about 2,500 miles, and that took about 5 months.
What do you think about when you're in a boat by yourself for 8 hours, rowing along?
It's funny because when people hear about these trips, they try to make us out as being brave or adventurous. And for the most part, I don't think that the miles are a function of strength or bravery. It's simply repetitive motion over a long period of time, a lot of strokes. And probably the hardest part of the trips is mastering yourself rather than trying to master the wind or the waves. And that is, what do you think about? And how do you keep yourself entertained sometimes? Most of the time, the country is just so intriguing that you're thinking about geology or you're thinking about history, or sometimes you're thinking about friends. On the Mackenzie River was really the only place where I've ever been so hot and tortured by mosquitoes that sounded like helicopters that I couldn't think of anything to think about other than what I was going to think about. And that's pretty rare. But I actually bungee corded a book to my feet and tried to read as I rolled back and forth for 1,000 miles down this river.
How far did you get into the book?
I read all of Wallace Stegner's Angle of Repose, which is one of my favorite books.
I was going to say, if you're going to choose one, that's a good one to go along with. Another of the early trips that you took, when you were rowing, but Doug, I think, was still kayaking, you ended up in a place with whales and found yourself out in the middle with a whale ready to surface under you. That sounds to me extraordinarily dangerous.
There were a lot of things on that first trip we didn't know. And one of the things we didn't know was if we were going to make it, because you sort of find out that people are very quick to tell you what you can't do. We didn't know that we saw the world differently until what you're talking about with this whale. And we were about 1,000 miles up the Inside Passage. It was a beautiful blue sky day. There was a humpback whale swimming about 100 yards away from us, just paralleling us for a couple miles. And we were just right along the rocks. And then we reached a 3-mile-wide bay where we had to leave the security of the shoreline behind and cross. And that whale chose that moment to disappear. So as we looked across this bay, there was no sign of it anywhere. So I said, Doug, let's wait and see where this whale shows up. And Doug said, we waited a few minutes. And then he said, well, you know, we could wait forever. Let's go. And he's learned to listen to me at least most of the time because we got about 2/3 of the way across this bay. And Doug looked down. He said, look, Jill, there's bubbles here. And I looked down and I said, oh, yeah, there's bubbles here too. And I'm generally rowing about 15 feet ahead of him and looking back towards him because he's in the kayak facing forward. And then we realized that the bubbles just weren't right next to us, but they were in a circle that was about 60 feet around. And humpback whales feed by emitting this tiny circle of bubbles, and the fish think that they're in a net. So they go towards the middle, and the middle is where the whale is. And where the whale is, there's this big lens of whale breath. And as Doug looked down, the big bubble of whale breath was about 15 feet underneath them and coming up fast.
You pulled faster, perhaps, than you would ordinarily pull at that point.
Yeah, and as we were paddling with everything we had away, this whale burst from the water about 10 feet behind where Doug was. So I had a perfect view of it since I was facing that direction. Its tail was about 12 feet wide and had water streaming off the tail. And Doug, as he's, you know, red-faced, is saying, take a picture, Jill, take a picture. I said, forget it. What was funny about that story is that night we were on shore and we talked about where we were in relation to the whale and what had happened, and our stories just didn't jive at all. I mean, it was as though we had seen different whales in separate oceans. And the more we talked about it, the madder we got. And I was sure I was right, and Doug was absolutely convinced he was right. And he'd never even seen the whale. So finally he suggested that we each draw pictures, kind of sketch the scene of how we saw it. And we looked at these pictures, and they just didn't jive at all. And we got madder, so mad that Doug was sitting right next to me, and all I could think of is, you know, where had he learned to suck in so much air so loudly, and where had he learned to breathe like that? And then he started to laugh, and it was one of these deep laughs that seemed very disrespectful of my view. And when he finally got the breath to explain, he said that we had drawn the same picture, but that I had drawn mine facing backwards the way I look when I row, therefore towards both him and the whale, and he had drawn his facing the other way. And it was a question of perspective. He still insists, quite annoyingly to this day, that I had drawn my picture upside down.
Jill Fredston is the author of Rowing to Latitude, Journeys Along the Arctic Edge. Jim Fleming talked with her when the book was first out. There's a word for someone who loves the cold. I know you're thinking crazy, but the word is actually cryophile. Bill Strever is a biologist who describes himself as a cryophile. He lives in Anchorage, Alaska, but makes frequent trips to even colder places. He's the author of Cold, a book Steve Paulson found a little terrifying.
You actually start your book by describing what it was like to dive into Prudhoe Bay in Alaska, 300 miles north of the Arctic Circle, wearing only your swimming suit when the water temperature was 35. I have to say, that sounds pretty cold.
You know, and that's what seems to excite people, is this guy dives into this freezing cold water. But diving in, that's actually, you know, not that unusual for people that come to Alaska, and even for some Alaskans, but certainly tourists that go up to the North Slope. They love the idea and sometimes the actuality of jumping into the ice-cold water of the Arctic as kind of a polar bear plunge sort of a sport. But what I did was a little bit differently, because I plunged in and then stayed in for 5 minutes. I wanted to see what it was like to begin experiencing cold water hypothermia, in part for the book, but also the main reason I did it was because I do work around the water, and there's always a possibility of falling over the side. I wanted to know what that would feel like if I fell over the side. I wanted to know what it would be like to get control of the gasp reflex. So as soon as you hit that cold water, you're unconsciously starting to gasp. And that gasp reflex kills a lot of people. They hit the water, they start to gasp, they get a lung full of water, and they drown. And it started this reputation of very cold water as something that kills people in minutes. And usually if people die in minutes, they're dying from drowning because they gasp in a chest full of that very cold water.
So if you don't actually gasp, what starts happening to your body? Did you feel it shutting down?
Oh, yeah. You feel your at least for me anyway, I feel like my skin is being shrink-wrapped, and you can feel your muscles tightening and your capillaries and your extremities are starting to shut down. And the gasp reflex goes away pretty quickly. So as long as you can keep your head above water for as little as 30 seconds or a minute, you can get past that gasp reflex and regain control of yourself for a while. And then slowly different things start to happen. And it depends a little bit on what you're wearing. But before too long in water that cold, your muscles start to cramp. So if you're not wearing a life preserver, then you would drown. And if you are wearing a life preserver, eventually your muscles are cramped and you're more or less incapacitated, but you can last quite a long time as long as your head is held up above water.
Now, there are two major cold weather hazards we tend to hear about. One is hypothermia. The other is frostbite. And they're really two very different things, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Totally different things. Hypothermia is the cooling of your body temperature, the cooling of your core temperature. Frostbite is the actual freezing of your extremities or the skin in your face, your ears, your nose, your fingers, your toes. It's truly freezing, so the liquids in your body are freezing. They're turning to ice crystals. Those crystals are destroying cell membranes and tissues and possibly not killing you as a person, because you could have a foot totally lost to frostbite and amputated and still certainly survive. So it's a very different thing than hypothermia. Also, it does have to be below freezing for frostbite to occur, because it is freezing the liquids in your body.
Now, there are a number of stories, famous stories, of people who have braved extreme cold, and certainly the most famous stories are the polar explorers, especially those guys who went down to the South Pole. You have scoured this literature, clearly. Do you have favorite explorers or favorite stories?
My favorite explorers are always the guys who were ready to turn around when they realized that things weren't going as they had planned or as they had hoped. They were ready to turn around and bail out and save themselves and their companions.
Ernest Shackleton, for instance.
Shackleton, he turned around more than once, and quite famously once, and I don't remember the exact quote, but I think he wrote something to his wife along the lines of, "I'd rather be a live donkey than a dead lion." Meaning that he'd rather be alive and considered a coward than be brave and dead, as many other explorers were.
And the thing to remember is he got really close to the South Pole. He was, 97 miles away when he turned back in 1909?
Yeah, something like that. That's right. It's tough. Anybody that does any kind of exploration work, it's very tough to maintain the drive of an explorer. You're a very goal-oriented person. You want to do something. But to balance that against reality and your own limitations and being able to say it's time to turn around, or even having a plan in place that says if this set of conditions occurs, we're turning around. And I can't tell you how many times, and I wouldn't consider myself an explorer, but various things I've been involved in where there was a plan to turn around if these conditions occurred. And then those conditions occur, and people stand around debating whether or not they should stick around and stick to their plan or whether or not they should keep going, which to me is just madness. If you have a plan, stick to it. You made that plan for a reason, and it's time to turn around.
What was the hardest part of these polar explorations? Was it just dealing with all that cold for so many weeks, or is it running out of supplies? What was hardest?
You know, one theme that comes through in the journals and memoirs of many of the explorers is that the hardest part is the planning. And I think that says a lot for the personalities of explorers. These are people that want to go out and do something. They want to be out there on the ice, on the snowpack, whatever. They want to be out there in the action. And yet these explorations required years of planning, years of finding financial backers, years of screening out potential candidates as companions. Very tough stuff to do. And, you know, I think all too often people that aren't familiar with Arctic exploration or exploration in general, they think that the big skill sets are the skill sets of how to move across the snow, how to move across the ice, how to climb a mountain. But really a big part of the skill sets were around leadership.
For those people who didn't make it during those polar expeditions or who almost died but then managed to survive, how did they describe those final days or the days near death? I mean, was impending death very painful, or was it actually not so bad as the cold really set in?
I don't think I would ever describe it as not so bad, but one of the common threads that you see in the journals that are salvaged from people who have died is apathy. So as people are gradually dying, they're, of course, constantly cold and they're running out of food, so they're also starving at the same time as their body temperature is slowly dropping. So all these things are going on at once, and people are becoming increasingly apathetic. So I think that might tone down to some degree their suffering. The other thing you see, so it's apathy on the one hand, but it's what I think of as the stiff upper lip on the other hand. As Scott tells it, it seemed all very British, the stiff upper lip. Sure, we're suffering, but we're okay with that. Let's have a cup of tea if we can thaw it out.
Now, there are probably some people who think global warming may not be such a bad thing, especially if they live in Alaska or some other very cold place. But you don't feel that way, do you?
Well, not really. You know, there's always this group of – there's always deniers, of course, climate change deniers. We all know them. But there's this other fringe group. I call them Alaskans for global warming. And, you know, it's easy to say in the depths of winter up here, and our winter even in Anchorage runs on the long side, and it's easy to say, man, I wish global warming would hurry up and get here so I could get out of this winter mode of living that I'm in now. And one of the things I talk about a little bit in the book and that I try to remind people of now and again is that we really are right now at the tail end of the Pleistocene ice ages, at the tail end of the most recent glaciated period of the Pleistocene. This is not a planet that's in an extremely warm stage right now. We do seem to be headed that way. We do seem to be leading toward a period when we're going to lose, for example, the summertime sea ice, and hopefully not in our lifetimes, but possibly lose the Greenland ice. To me, that would be the end of the ice age. So when I say we're still in the ice age, that's what I mean.
Bill Strever's the author of Cold, Adventures in the World's Frozen Places. He spoke with Steve Paulson. There's more information about cold adventures on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up next, writer Jonathan Lethem shares the best book you've never heard of and what's on our minds this week. Super Bowl Sunday, of course. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Lethem. I write novels. The one I've just written is a historical book called Dissident Gardens about New York in the 1950s, among other things. The book I want to recommend to you connects somewhat to that. It's a memoir by a guy named Anatole Broyard, and it's called Kafka Was the Rage. It's set in the 40s and early 50s, I think. It's a very short book, a very beautiful, strange, in some ways withholding, certainly by the standard of what we think of as the memoir. It doesn't tell you everything by any measure, but it's such a vivid and iconoclastic glimpse of the intellectual and social and artistic life of Greenwich Village at a certain point in the recent past that when you read it, you feel it might as well be 1,000 years ago or be Paris in the 1850s or something. It's just a beautiful little immersion in a completely different version of the world that you might think you know when you think of the American bohemian or the life of a hipster in Greenwich Village. Broillard is a strange character who is much more talked about, if he's remembered at all, than read. He was a very famously merciless book reviewer, and so people sometimes still remember his great destructions of other writers. He has become controversial recently because he has been asserted by some people to have been the model for a character in a Philip Roth book called The Human Stain. He was a man who was passing for a lot of his life. He was an African-American passing for white, and to do so as brazenly as he did in the sophisticated social and intellectual worlds he moved through made him a kind of a fascinating character to consider in retrospect, and controversial one, divisive one. But what's lost in all of this is that he actually wrote a couple of really splendid things. And Kafka Was the Rage is about as good a memoir, a literary memoir, as is out there. When my friend Matthew Spector heard I was trying to tackle Greenwich Village in the 40s and 50s and 60s, he immediately demanded I read this book. It became one of the essential documents for me. It's very humbling when you go around kind of believing you have a feel for something, and then the real intimate and specific texture of other lives is always, it always demands of you that you get outside yourself and your assumptions. And this book served beautifully that purpose for me.
Jonathan Lethem is the author of The Fortress of Solitude. His latest novel is Dissident Gardens. You'll find more bookmarks and interviews with Jonathan Lethem on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, Super Bowl Sunday is on our minds. For football fans, one of the most sacred days of the year. Does it seem a little odd that we celebrate the sacrament of the pigskin on the one day of the week that in many religious traditions is a holy day? In a book called Sunday, historian Craig Harline puts the day in context, explaining how we got from the Sabbath to the Super Bowl.
Well, it takes me 380 pages to explain that, but I'll try to give you the short answer. Basically, after about 400, Sunday became a full day free from work, and therefore there began to be discussion over what should be done the rest of the day, thus outside of worship. That's when Sunday began to take on this more Sabbath-like character. Christians debated, what is the nature of Sunday? Should it be like the Jewish Sabbath? Should it have different rules from the Jewish Sabbath, but the same spirit, essentially? And that's when it really began. And during the Middle Ages, that tendency toward the creation of what Christians called a sort of Christian Sabbath continued. The Puritans in the 16th and 17th century in England and in the Americas solidified that tradition, and they called Sunday the Sabbath. They didn't say it was merely a sort of Sabbath or a figurative Sabbath. It was the Sabbath, true and proper. It had been reinstituted by God on the new day of the week and so on. And so therefore, the religious elements of Sunday have been there a long time.
So you've done a kind of interesting thing in this book. Rather than just kind of march through the history, you've sort of singled out Sundays in different historical periods and sort of done a vignette, a profile of how the day might have been celebrated by some typical people. So let's take a look at some of those. For instance, medieval Catholic England. How did a typical person, how would you or I have experienced Sunday if we were living then?
Right. I noted that there, I thought, would be four themes. Working, a better meal than usual, church, and a lot of fun. And the working is a little bit surprising because by the Middle Ages, it was pretty clear that Christians were not supposed to work on Sunday. It had taken on the character of a rest day, just like the Jewish Sabbath. But because almost everyone was a farmer or peasant of some kind, there were things that have to be done every day of the week, as farmers today know as well. So during the summer months, at least, Sunday would often include a bit of work. But that would be followed by church. We don't know exactly how many people attended church, but everyone belonged to the church. They were baptized into it and born into it.
What did people do for fun in medieval England?
Well, they played games, not necessarily the same games we would. There was an early form of football already by this time, but there was archery and so forth. But mostly they went to taverns and socialized. I think that was one of the big purposes of Sunday. That was the day when you would especially see a lot of people and you could relax.
Was there much of a conflict even back then about how people used Sunday? I mean, did some church leaders think that people shouldn't go to the tavern and drink and people should
Yes.
just stay home and worship?
Yeah, the tension began again after about 500 when the church began to give Sunday a series of rules. These are things you should and shouldn't do on Sunday. And so, yes, there was always a sort of tension. But people ended up pretty much doing what they wanted to do, I think.
And what about after the Protestant Reformation? Did Sunday change much then? In general, I think of the Protestants as having had a great deal many more rules.
It did change. In fact, the Catholic Sunday and the Protestant Sunday, if you look at the theory, they weren't that different from each other. The real distinguishing point for me was more the English/Puritan Sunday. Puritans were a minority in the English church, but the sort of Sunday they envisioned wasn't that different from what the majority of English church people envisioned as well. It tended to be stricter than just about everyone else. So the essential dividing line, I do show a Protestant Sunday in the book, but one of the reasons I show it is to illustrate that it wasn't that different from a Catholic Sunday. The real difference was with the English Sunday.
You know the Little House on the Prairie books?
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading one of those, and the description of a Sunday was so different than it is now. And I just remember the children were supposed to sit still, and they were supposed to spend the whole day reading scripture. And I think
right.
somebody got whipped because they went out sledding when they weren't supposed to. When did that kind of Sunday appear?
That's definitely from the English and Puritan tradition. And that was an important tradition in the Americas as well. Of course, a lot of the first settlers came to New England. But settlers who came along the rest of the eastern seaboard generally did not insist on such a strict Sunday as that. So in the Americas, you had both traditions. But that English Puritan tradition was very strong. And typically, the insistence on a strict Sunday comes from that tradition.
Hmm. Now, there's another kind of Sunday, a whole different Sunday tradition that you focus on. Maybe we could fast forward to 19th century France, because that's a very different sort of Sunday, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it also includes some of the elements that we've seen earlier in history or earlier in the book. That is, there's certainly opportunity for church and so on. But by now, there are a lot of other things going on Sunday as well. Not everyone has to belong to a church anymore. So they also enjoy their day off, which is Sunday. So the Sunday in France, which to me was the most famous Sunday ever, with the famous painting by Seurat and all the cafe scenes and all the depictions of Sunday scenes in novels and short stories, this is the Sunday that everybody held up as the thing to love or as the thing to hate. Now, most people loved it, but again, it was the English Puritan tradition that didn't like the French model. They regarded it as licentious and so on. And if you compare it to an English Sunday, in fact, there was a lot more going on in France.
What kind of Sunday was it? What did people do?
Well, it could include church, but it certainly included opportunities to go to cafes, restaurants. Restaurant was a new invention, a big invention in the late 19th century. It included lots of parks that were available in France, pleasure trains to the ocean. If you lived in Paris, for instance, walking down the boulevard would often offer entertainment enough because people went out to be seen and to see other people. So the famous promenade of the French Sunday. So there are a lot of park scenes, a lot of cafe scenes, a lot of things going on outdoors.
So Sunday was really a play day.
Well, it was, but you could say that that was true in the Middle Ages as well, that there's always this element of holy day and holiday. Those have come to mean two opposite things in modern English, but in the Middle Ages, they meant exactly the same thing. And it's probably not bad to think about that, to think that a holy day usually includes holiday sorts of things, and a holiday might include holy day sorts of things. So, in other words, the two terms go together.
So how do you see these two strands playing out today in modern-day America in the Sunday that we've evolved?
Well, you can see the Puritan strain still, and you can see the continental European strain still. The Puritan strain is still alive in certain religious denominations. Certainly, you can see that all the high activity of a Sunday, the sporting events and so forth, that definitely comes from the continental European traditions. And they kind of fuse into something distinctly American. In fact, the tendency to have a lot of sporting activities on Sunday is more American than it is either European or English.
Has writing this book changed anything about the way you approach your Sundays?
Now that I'm an old guy, maybe not. If I had been a kid, I probably would have played more. But as an old guy, I don't mind resting on Sunday anymore. I think it's certainly, if you come from kind of the stricter English tradition, it maybe helps you re-envision Sunday, that there are more possibilities than you imagine, and that the English tradition is just one alternative.
So the subtext of your book could be getting rid of Sunday guilt?
I suppose it could be that. Or just re-envisioning it for yourself, you know, how you want to make it a more creative Sunday.
I have to confess, Sunday is probably my least favorite day of the week. And over the years, I mean, there's a particular kind of dread and sort of feeling in the pit of my stomach, Sunday afternoons especially, you know, the weekend's coming to an end and you really have to start kind of thinking about work again. I used to think that was just me, and over the years I've come to realize that a lot of people have that kind of Sunday dread, and it does kind of color my perception of the whole day. Did you find that that's true of a lot of people?
Well, I didn't go and do interviews or make a systematic study, but that was the impression I got. And that, in fact, one psychologist coined a term called Sunday neurosis. I thought about that and I thought, well, there could be at least two kinds of Sunday neuroses. The first kind that he meant was the kind that dreads Sunday's coming because it means an end to the routine of the week. And when routine stops, you have to stop and think about things. You might even have to question your routine. You might have to ask the big questions, like, what am I doing? What's the purpose of all this? The routine sometimes distracts you from all the big questions of life. So some people don't like that seizing of the routine. I think the kind that you're talking about is more in the French model, and that is you like Sunday so much that you can't stand to see it go. You're just dreading Monday coming again, and when you have to go out of this kind of timeless existence that might emerge, at least briefly, on Sunday.
Well, you know, I think doctors tell us that most heart attacks happen Monday mornings, so evidently a lot of people feel that way.
Maybe other people feel the same way. But then there are people who can't wait to get back to work. That's why I found that bumper sticker humorous, which said, thank God it's Monday. Because, of course, before it was always, thank God it's Friday. But this time, thank God it's Monday. They're so glad that the lack of routine of Sunday is past.
Just another manic Monday. Wish it was Sunday. That's my fun day. I don't have to run day. Just another manic Monday.
Craig Harline is the author of Sunday, a history of the first day from Babylonia to the Super Bowl. That's what's on our minds today. We post a new On Our Minds segment on our website every day. Look for them at ttbook.org. And you can also find out about our new flash fiction contest, 3-Minute Futures.
In a world where your food doesn't always taste like chicken,
Soylent Green is people.
In a world where our simian siblings have taken over,
you maniac!
To the Best of Our Knowledge invites you to create your own world. Share your vision of the near future with 3-Minute Futures, a flash fiction contest. Best-selling science fiction novelist Kim Stanley Robinson will choose the top 3 stories. They will air on TT Book. For details, visit ttbook.org.
To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Stephanie Youngblood. Steve Mullen at Walk West Music composed our new theme music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.